Dinosaur Summer is set in the year 1947 in a world a little different from ours, in which Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Grand Tapuis, the Lost World, are real. I've modified them a little bit, and I've put some characters who are favorites of mine, real people, into an adventure set on the Lost World. Ray Harryhausen, famous animator and movie maker, and Willis O'Brien, the man who animated King Kong, among my favorite people in the motion picture industry, and I thought I would return the favor. Since they exposed me to dinosaurs, I would expose them to dinosaurs. At this point in my novel, in the sixth chapter of book two, our characters are lost on the Lost World. No big surprise. But my young character, Peter Belzoni, is with Ray Harryhausen, and he's in the middle of learning some significant lessons about the Lost World and about himself. Chapter 6. Peter came awake in darkness. Ray shook his shoulder. "Almost a half moon and clear skies tonight," he said. "Let's get moving." "We're going back?" Peter asked. "We need to find some high ground first. One of these tors might be suitable. We could thrash our way through this forest and never know which way to turn. Right now, which way is south?" "We can tell by the stars," Peter said. Ray chuckled. "If we could, if you knew how to do it. I don't." Peter felt his face burn. "Next time, we'll have to remember to bring our Boy Scout manuals. If we learn a few landmarks, we can keep a good sense of direction." The tors dotted the jungle every few hundred yards. "What about nocturnal hunters?" Peter asked. "Are they any worse than day hunters?" "At least we can see better in the daytime." "So we see them before they eat us? Any other arguments?" Ray sounded testy. "No," Peter said. "I'd rather be doing something than just sitting here waiting to die." "Amen," Ray said. Ambition was easier than accomplishment. They stumbled through the velvety dark forest for half an hour before deciding to follow the stream again. Ray did not remember any tors south of where they were. Peter could not visualize their location well at all. They went north along the stream, more to be doing something than with any plan in mind. Following the stream was not easy. Tree trunks and leaves thrust out over the banks until they had to walk in the stream itself, which Ray did not enjoy. "I remember the teeth on that fish," he said. "Let's stay to the shallows." The moonlight was less help than Ray had anticipated, and after a while he began to get discouraged. "I don't know why we're even trying," he grumbled. He plunged up to his knees into a hole in the stream bed. A cloud of stinging gnats enveloped them before Peter could take his turn to give a pep talk. Swatting and swearing, they splashed half blindly in the stream and on the bank. Finally, Peter ducked himself completely underwater and swam a few yards until he bumped against a submerged rock. He stood and saw Ray splashing along the surface close behind. "Jesus, Jesus," Ray swore with each stroke. Peter expected to feel fish mouths nibbling at him and scrambled up onto the shore. He crawled along a tilted tree trunk and grabbed at dead, rock-hard creepers. The river curved in such a way that moonlight now fell full between the halves of a parted forest, painting in shimmering bands of white on the stream. Ray was surrounded by a carpet of diamonds as he splashed ashore. He stopped in the shallows, body tensed, standing in only a few inches of water, staring downstream at something hidden from Peter by the dense overhang of foliage. He seemed transfixed. "What is it?" Peter asked. "A salamander," Ray said. Peter wiped water from his eyes. "What? Come on." "No," Ray said, eyes still locked on the unseen animal. "It's a kind of amphibian, I'm sure. Ray, get out of the water." Ray held out his hand with fingers spread toward Peter. "I've never seen anything like it, not even fossils. It doesn't look like a Diplocallis." Peter made a face and screwed up his courage. He walked out into the stream and stood beside Ray on the pebbly bed. "Quiet," Ray said. "Who knows what it eats or how fast it moves?" "Great," Peter whispered and stared downstream. The moonlight shone on a still pool set aside from the stream's flow. Trees surrounded the pool on three sides. On a patch of sloping shore stretched a nightmare length of shiny dark flesh, 8 or 9 feet from its yard-wide, scythe-shaped head to its thick, wrinkled, partly submerged tail. The creature raised its wide blade of a head, eyes mounted on the extreme ends of the scythe, and blinked lazily. "It's like a shark," Peter whispered, all his misery temporarily forgotten. "A hammerhead axolotl," Ray agreed, boyish enthusiasm in his subdued voice. "Look at the gills!" Behind the creature's jaw puffed faint flowers of paler color against the dark flesh. The amphibian cheeped. None of the three moved. "Dawn of time stuff," Ray said. "Why such a broad head? Think of the stereo vision." A thick bank of cloud covered the moon and dropped them into pure black ink. Peter felt the darkness as a viscous resistance. Disoriented, he reached out for Ray, touched his arm, and said, "Let's get out of here." "I want to see it again," Ray said. "Ray!" Something big splashed in the pool. "Ray, let's get out of here!" Gripping Ray's forearm, Peter dragged him to the unseen bank of the stream. They collided with an overhanging limb and almost lost their balance, but managed to blindly creep onto the leaning tree trunk and squat there like frogs. "What a wonderful monster," Ray said. The clouds parted briefly, allowing a final shaft of crystalline moonlight to sparkle on the flowing water and the shimmering leaves. Darkness closed in again. Peter couldn't see his hand in front of his face. It began to rain. Hard. Chapter 7. The upper and middle canopy of the forest sounded like the rhythm section in a big band. Fat drops of rain hit the leaves like brush sizzles on a snare drum. Drips landed on the lower leaves and floor like taps on a hi-hat. "Damn," Ray said, "we forgot our bumper shoots." There was nowhere to go in the darkness, so they sat blind on the tilted trunk. Peter nursed his sore shoulder and arm, rubbing his joints and grimacing. He licked at the drops that fell from his hair, and he was suddenly very hungry again. "Where's your camera?" Peter asked. The question had just popped into his head. "I threw it at a dog lizard," Ray said. "How's that for dedication to my craft?" Silence between them for a moment, listening to the rain's music. Then, "You went back and got your machete, didn't you?" "Yeah." "Still have it?" "Yeah." It seemed glued to Peter's hand. His grip on the tape-wrapped handle was so tight. He couldn't remember swimming with it, but he must have, and without slicing his legs off, either. "We're not helpless, then. We can whack something." "We could find more edible roots." "I'll eat tree bark and ants pretty soon," Ray said. Peter wondered what ants did in the wet. "It's going to be dawn in a few minutes," Ray said. "Isn't it getting a little brighter?" Peter couldn't tell at first, but after a while he could make out pieces of wet sky through gaps in the trees. The rain continued unabated, however, and soon a fork of lightning cast a ghoulish glare over the forest. Ray came and went in a flash before Peter, squatting like a gargoyle on the tree. The rain suddenly doubled, and the music became a steady, pounding roar so loud they could barely hear each other. "I don't like this," Ray shouted. "We're down in a little gully here, about 2 yards below the..." Upstream, they heard a sharp crack, a splintering, and a deeper rumble. There was not enough light to see more than vague shadows, but Peter felt Ray's foot on his arm and reached out to grab a knee. "What?" he called. We should get to higher ground. This might be an arroyo, a flood channel." "Right," Peter said. He slithered down the tree onto the spongy forest floor and felt rather than heard Ray close behind. Walking any farther was difficult. Branches and vines reached out to grab, and Ray collided with him. "We've got to get to an open space," Ray shouted. "There isn't any until we..." Peter heard the sudden roar reach a crescendo. The flood hit them first at their knees, knocking them over backward. Then a second wall struck, engulfing them. Peter struggled to keep to his feet, but the water dug dirt out from beneath his boots, and the third wall spun him like a child's ball. His head poked briefly into air and then submerged again. Something hit his shoulder, poked sharply at his ear, and slammed against the back of his neck. He could not move or breathe. Eyes wide open, he flopped and rolled and swirled down the channel cut by the stream, bumping into tree trunks, sliding over rocks, helpless. When Peter came back to himself, and it seemed he had been on a long, long journey through a confused landscape of painful dreams, he was walking on the shore of a small lake. The trees on this shore were spaced far apart, and the forest floor was almost free of growth. Warm sun fell on him and the pebbly beach around him. His fingers tightened around a wooden handle. Somehow he had managed once again to keep a grip on the machete. He was walking toward a body tangled in debris a few yards away. He knew the person was dead. "Ray," he said. The body stirred, and an arm reached dramatically for the sky. "Yes, what is it?" the body replied. "You all right?" "Hell no." "I think I made it." "What about me? Did I make it?" "I wasn't sure at first, but you're talking." This idiotic conversation seemed perfectly natural. All Peter's fear and pain seemed suspended. He might have been on vacation trying to find a friend. He unwrapped creepers and branches from Ray's body and head. Ray raised his eyes to Peter's face, winced, and said, "Just my head?" "I think the rest of you is here, too." Ray struggled out of the mud and debris. His eyes stared from a face painted with swipes of half-dried dirt. Peter looked down at himself. He was covered with mud. "You're a mess," Ray said. "So are you." Anything broken? I don't think so. Me neither, I think. Ray took a tentative step. A true, honest-to-God miracle. Where are we? Peter asked. The lake stretched for about a quarter of a mile, bounded on most of its shore by thick forest. They could not see around the bend of shore to determine if it met up with a larger body of water. Peter found the sun at its 10 o'clock position, he estimated, and decided they were on the southern shore. He looked due east and saw a white prominence rising just above the tops of the trees, a tor. We can climb that and look around, he said, pointing. I'm not climbing anything, Ray said, falling back on his butt on the sandy shore and sinking his head between his knees. Peter felt too tired to argue or do much more than stand. Still, he thought fuzzily, they had to do something. He turned slowly, stumbling because of a weakness in one leg, recovered, and looked west. Debris had spilled from the stream mouth into the lake, forming a raft, a camalote, of foliage, small logs, branches, and scum. In the debris floated a small green body. Peter struggled through the wrack a few yards east to see the green body more closely. It was a reptile or dinosaur about 3 feet long. He couldn't tell more than that. He walked back to Ray and asked in a flat voice, "How hungry are you?" Ray looked up, irritated by the obvious question. "Enough," he said. "Not polite to talk about it." "All right," Peter said, and meticulously waded out to the debris raft. The green body was fresh, and Peter figured it weighed about 20 or 25 pounds, a good-sized turkey. It resembled a small struthio, but with large eyes and no feathery scales. He dropped it in front of Ray, and they both stared at it. The head flopped on its long neck, half-open red eye fixed dully on nothing in particular. Ray lifted his face to squint at Peter. A light mist had settled over the small lake. "I've been thinking," Ray said. "About what?" Peter asked. "How long we can last here." "Not very long without food." "This is food?" Ray asked. "Yeah," Peter said with a sigh. He lifted the machete. "Raw?" Ray said. "I suppose," Peter said. Peter squatted by the carcass and lifted one limp leg. Then he brought the machete down on the hip joint and split the skin. Pale pink muscle and yellowish fat showed through the slice. He hacked again. 10 or 11 hacks and some sawing removed the leg, and Peter tried to use the machete to cut away the thin, tough skin. The work was tiring, but he managed to rip off a strip of thigh and handed it to Ray. Ray took it, examined it with narrowed eyes, and bit into it. Peter cut himself a piece and was surprised to find he had no qualms about putting it in his mouth. He was too hungry to care how it tasted or felt. After they had eaten both legs to the bone, leaving only the horny skin around the clawed toes, they lay back on the beach and stared up at the golden fog surrounding them. "Amazing," Ray said. "What, having food?" "I ache all over. I've got bruises and welts on every square inch of my body, and there's a good chance I'll be dead in a day or two. But I feel pretty good." "A full belly," Peter said. He didn't feel good, but he didn't feel bad either. They heard a low droning noise. Peter tried to locate the direction, but it seemed to come from everywhere. "That's an airplane," Ray said, sitting up on his elbows. The mist was starting to thin above them, and they saw patches of blue sky and higher, puffy clouds with gray bellies. They both scanned the patches. Suddenly, the drone turned into a coughing roar, and a big high-winged scout plane passed over the forest and the lake at about 100 feet. They both stood and waved frantically, but the plane continued on a straight course until it was out of sight behind the wall of mist. "Didn't see us," Peter said. "At least they were looking." "Who?" Peter said. "They must be flying out of San Pedro or Ururian," Ray said. "Where can they land? Are they going to find us, or will we find them?" Peter suddenly felt very excited. I was thinking about earlier about finding the place where Jimmy Angel crashed. Maybe that would be a landing field," and Ray shook his head. "He crashed, Pete. Must not be a very good place to land if an ace pilot crashes. But maybe they would know how to find the plane, if it isn't covered with forest by now." Peter would not give up. The food made all the difference in the world. His spirits started to soar at the multitude of plans frantically crowding into his head. "But if they can see the plane, maybe they'll fly over it, and if we're there, they'll see us." "We'd have to find the plane first," Ray said. "Then we'll climb a tor and look around." Ray shrugged, then smiled. "All right." He stared dubiously at the small, dismembered dinosaur torso. "We can't waste food." Peter began enthusiastically cutting up the rest of the carcass. He disemboweled it with astonishing objectivity, for a boy who had felt faint dissecting frogs in school, and washed the well-hacked body parts. in the lake water. "Do we want to save the liver and stuff?" he asked Ray. "Let's not carry this too far. How do we know parts of these animals aren't poisonous?" Peter agreed and looked around for something to carry the chunks of meat in. A broad, tough leaf about 2 feet wide served the purpose, and he tied it with a fern stem. As they were about to head east into the forest, something slopped in the lake shallows. The scythe-headed amphibian, or one very much like it, swam sinuously through the water and crawled up on shore. Its slick, wrinkled skin was patterned in dark green and black spots, with touches of yellow and red along its back. With a slow hunch of its upper body and twist of its broad head, it gobbled the small dinosaur's innards. When it finished, it turned its widespread golden-brown eyes on them, then padded around and slithered back to the lake. Peter shivered. Ray watched it depart with fascination. "What a monster," he said again, as if a 9-foot-long salamander were any more monstrous than a pack of bear-sized Lycos.